Well, from the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Hey, by the way, the Digicam is up and running. If you want to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, it is, by the way, not of the cave, but my friend, Premier Radio Network's Blair Garner. He hosts a program called After Midnight. Well, he's got a new friend with him. He's called it Little George. You might want to take a look at that picture. Also, Lex has posted under the feature article a very fascinating story called 10 Puzzling Artifacts. It's about some various mysterious things that have occurred on this planet for thousands of years. You might want to take a look at that. That is worth a full program all by itself. Later on tonight, a former UFO attorney, Peter Gersten. So get ready for this one on Coast to Coast. Here's some of the news of the day. In Iraq, troops in place, the borders were closed, the ballots were ready early Thursday ahead of Iraqi parliamentary elections. The U.S. hopes will build democracy. A coalition of Shiite religious parties, which dominate the current government, was expected to win the latest number of seats, but not enough to form a new administration without alliances from rival groups. However, police arrested, while all this was going on, two suspected insurgents carrying 72 bombs, and a loud explosion was heard in central Baghdad. On the eve of Iraq's historic election, President Bush took responsibility for wrong intelligence that led to the war, but he said removing Saddam Hussein was still necessary. He said it is true that much of the intelligence turned out to be wrong, Bush said during his fourth and final speech before Thursday's vote for Iraq's parliament. As president, he says, I am responsible for these decisions to go into Iraq, and I'm also responsible for fixing what went wrong by reforming our intelligence capabilities, and we're doing just that. Meanwhile, his polls are up. The president's approval rating, though it's still low, is up another 4% from November, up to 42%. The Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, escalated his anti-Israeli rhetoric. I don't know what kind of trouble this guy is headed for, but he's pushing some of the wrong buttons. Calling the Holocaust a myth used by Europeans to create a Jewish state in the heart of the Islamic world. He said today they have created a myth in the name of the Holocaust and consider it to be above God, religion, and the prophets, he told thousands of people in Iran. His remarks drew swift condemnation from Israel, Germany, and the European Commission. Germany said the remarks would affect upcoming negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. In Paterson, New Jersey, four people found shot to death early Wednesday morning in an after-hours club in the city's industrial section. The four victims, three men and a woman, were slain in the game room of the four-room illegal club, which is on the second floor of a building that houses a machine shop. In Boston, investigators were searching for suspects in the city's bloodiest crime in a decade after four men there were fatally shot in a basement that neighbors said had been set up as a music studio. Three men were found dead at the house. A fourth died on his way to the hospital. In Richardson, Texas, no such thing as Santa Claus. That's what a suburban Dallas music teacher told first graders, and the school's been hearing from parents ever since. The angry phone calls prompted the Richardson School District to issue a pro-Santa statement. The district announced that the offending teacher had heard from Santa Claus himself, who assured the teacher that the spirit of the holidays is alive and well, and Santa asked the teacher to pass that message along to students. The district spokesperson says the teacher won't face any disciplinary action. A German woman has lost more than $6,000 after a would-be soothsayer convinced her that she was possessed by evil spirits and prescribed an expensive exorcism as a remedy. The 44-year-old was told that she was possessed by a young woman who had read her palm at a Christmas market. The victim became agitated and agreed to an exorcism at her home the following day, for which she paid the $6,000 in cash and jewelries. The exorcist then gave her more bad news, saying that there were other spirits that needed to be cast out of her. Police have arrested a 17-year-old woman from the former Yugoslavia. The victim's money and jewelry have been returned. Taiwan's company called Quanta The world's largest maker of notebook computers will manufacture an ultra-low-cost laptop developed by Nicholas Negroponte, the chairman of Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab. $100. That's all they're going to cost, and they're going to go to third world nations and also, hopefully, to other countries that cannot afford computers for kids. The European Space Agency says initial testing of a new plasma drive for spacecraft has been a success. The double-layer thruster is a new kind of ion drive, which would give as much power than existing versions. It works by accelerating charged particles between layers of argon plasma. Now, that's gas where the atoms have been stripped of electrons. They say that it has proven a principle that will work and will proceed with simulations and perhaps bigger prototypes. Already, though, NASA has deployed one on Deep Space One, which flew out of a comet in 2001. And Japan's space agency will delay until 2010 the return of a star-crossed space probe sent to collect samples from an asteroid after a thruster problem put the probe into an unexpected spin. In a moment, Coast to Coast science advisor and the head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, will comment on the Hayabusa probe and some other issues on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, Richard C. Hoagland has added to his EnterpriseMission.com website a 24/7 constantly updated headline feed on space, energy, technology, different kinds of policy. So all you have to do is get to the EnterpriseMission.com website. You can do that around the clock now to see the latest stories, cutting edge, and link directly to the source. That's a pretty good idea, Richard C.
Well, it's all possible because of computers. We don't have to do it by hand anymore. One of our really close associates wrote some code and found a whole bunch of feeds, including the DOD, the Pentagon, that sends out these information robots, so that we simply bundle them all, put them on the main page, and you can go there anytime, day or night now, and see what's going on anywhere in the world, including what's going on with this bizarre and forlorn Japanese probe.
Now, delayed until 2010 to return, and they still don't think now that they have any samples, right?
You know, this is the weirdest thing. They did two landings, one on the 20th and one on the 26th, where they basically touched. I mean, landing on this asteroid is not really the right term, because the asteroid is so low mass and so low gravity that it's really almost like a rendezvous as opposed mm-hmm. to a touchdown on a solid surface. So they had to do all kinds of delicate maneuvers via remote control. Remember, the spacecraft was 16 light minutes away, so nothing could be done live or in real time. And the computer carried out its mission, and it lowered the spacecraft carefully at a few tenths of an inch per second, which is almost not moving. And they touched down the first time, and they didn't know they touched down because the computer was sending them some wrong signals, and they had a switch of antennas, so they were not able to get the information back until hours and hours and hours later. And it turned out they'd spent about 30 minutes sitting on the surface of this almost massless object. And then a few days later, on the 26th, they tried it again. They found out when they downlinked the data that their little device for firing a bullet into the target, into the asteroid, which would kick up the dust that would then be collected in a cone-shaped device, sealed in a capsule that would ultimately be sent back to Earth, had not fired. The computer had inhibited the command to fire the bullet, so they didn't get, they thought, any material. So they did their second landing, almost a week later. And on that one, they double-checked and triple-checked and quadruple-checked, and they had teams of guys going over the code. And they disabled certain parts of the safing system so that if, as the spacecraft was gently coming down, its lasers saw, for instance, a rock, it wouldn't disable the firing mechanism, so they would get their sample. And all this seemed to work, and they reported the next day that everything seemed to work fine. And then the spacecraft went into total conniptions. Almost everything that could go wrong with this little thing went wrong. They sprang a leak in the thrusters. They lost the attitude control. They didn't have communications. And when they finally were able, between the 7th and now, to get at very, very low bit rates, the data downlinked from the computer, the onboard computer, as to what happened during that second landing sequence, it turned out that somehow, mysteriously, the computer had reinserted the inhibit command in the gun to fire the bullet, to kick up the dust, to collect the sample. And so they now think there's an 80% chance that it didn't work, and they've got an extremely thick spacecraft 300 miles away from the asteroid now, limping along, spinning out of control, basically, not communicating since the 9th with the Earth. They're not even getting any signals. They just are praying that it's still alive, and they are now in what they call a rescue mode, and they think it's going to take them until, get this, George, 2007 to recover control so they can ignite the engines, the ion engines, to send it on a long looping trajectory, very slow freight home that will get it back by 2010.
And they're not even sure that it's going to work at that point, are they?
Well, they're not sure that all kinds of things are not going to work. And the ultimate thing they're not sure of is, do they even have any samples in these little capsules that were supposed to collect the dust kicked up by the firing of this little gun? Now, what is so weird to me is that when you have so many people checking computer code, the idea that the computer can kind of take off on its own and do something is impossible. So I am just looking at this, and I'm asking myself, why in the world, after all that double checking, did they not get the sample? Because it doesn't seem to have been a mechanical problem. It was a computer code problem that somehow slipped by all these very, very smart and dedicated people.
And it seemed like it was working really well until the last
up
few
until
days.
They got, or thought they got, the sample.
Yep.
Now, I'm not going to go the next step, but this is the Coast audience, and they know me very well. So just extrapolate out what I might be thinking about all this.
Let's try to read your mind. No, it can't be.
Well, look, I had a nice little note from Tom Van Flander tonight, because I had sent him a note earlier in the day asking him if he saw as much confirmation for the exploded planet hypothesis in the Japanese data from Itokawa, which is the name of the asteroid, as I did. And he said, absolutely. And he wants me to actually make a list of all the confirmations that I see. And, you know, this is not a trivial mission. If this spacecraft works, ultimately, in 2010, we get the sample back, and they actually can analyze it in a terrestrial laboratory, and we confirm that instead of being primordial, primitive, never touched, look, ma, no hands kind of stuff from the origin of the solar system, that this asteroid really is part of a very, very, very processed planet that blew up, wouldn't that kind of make a dent in everyone's consciousness? And wouldn't that be maybe a reason not to maybe have the mission succeed by someone? Remember, this is Coast.
This is Coast, and this is Richard Hoagland.
Well, our job, George, as you know, was to think out of the box, to talk about things and think things that most people don't think of or are afraid to talk about. And I just know that we are living at the edge of some extraordinary paradigm shifts. There's another story that I want to talk about tonight, which is what's going on right here in New Mexico, which in an odd way is connected to some things that our good friend Peter Gersten is going to talk about in the next hour or two or three or four. And so Robin and I want to say hi to him. But he's going to talk about 2012, and I'll bet you didn't think that I would come up with a connection between the new New Mexico private spaceport and 2012, did you?
No, not at all. I'm looking forward to finding how you tied those two things together.
Okay.
But back to Hayabusa for just a moment. If you believe that something's gone wrong here. Maybe someone, if I'm reading you right, might have tampered with it somehow.
I'm not the only one who kind of is thinking in that direction. As you know, I've been reading all these blogs from Japan, and there's some excellent people doing English translations. And the Japanese press conferences are much more informal than the NASA versions. So reporters and students and, you know, even people like me get a chance to ask questions. Someone, not me, asked a question on, I believe, the 30th of November, which was 4 days after the unsuccessful attempt when the spacecraft went into this incredible set of problems.
Right.
And they basically said, do you think this was deliberate? And the project manager, instead of saying, oh, you got to be nuts, you know, get out of here, don't ask that kind of stupid question, what he did say was, we will not know until we download all the data.
He didn't deny it then.
He did not deny it. He did not say no comment. He simply said they won't know till they download all the data. And it turned out that the particular failure mode that the spacecraft suddenly went into wiped the computer clean of that critical data.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that interesting? Yes.
If, and I want you to tell us again, if for some reason it was tampered with, they didn't want the data to work correctly. They didn't want us to get it. They didn't want us to get the sample back. Why? Again, why? What's so earth-shattering about grabbing some material, maybe proving what you and Van Flandern have been saying for years? Big deal. I mean, that's an exciting story if there was an exploded planet out there somewhere. Why hide that?
Well, you just said it. You said, what's so earth-shattering? The answer is earth-shattering. If there was a planet and it blew up and created a comets and asteroids, and that is an indication of a physics that can do this, and that physics literally can destroy worlds, there may be some people that don't think the human race is ready to know that. I mean, that's one scenario.
Because maybe this planet could do the same thing?
Or someone could do that to it. In other words, we are now living in a fog of terrorism where everything is looked at as, could it be turned into a weapon? When you get on an airplane now, what do they take away from you? All kinds of mundane things that just a few months ago were completely normal to have on your person. Now you can't have them. Why? Because someone is paranoid enough to think that someone might turn that into a weapon. We're dealing with a level of physics here that makes hydrogen bombs look like kitchen matches. And if, in fact, there are ways to blow planets to kingdom come, and if there are people that don't think that the other people on this planet should know that, and that that would, bringing back samples of a world which had undergone that kind of incredible, wrenching, catastrophic event, would give some not nice people clues to look in certain directions they're not looking now. In other words, I'm just looking at possible scenarios. The more mundane scenario, of course, is that some people just don't want to be proven wrong, and ego is a huge factor in human civilization. I mean, a lot of things have happened simply because people didn't want to be embarrassed, George. The point is that we have a spacecraft that was doing wonderfully one moment and went through a series of very severe problems, including leaking fuel, valves that wouldn't latch, communications that went out, freezing cold, loss of subsystems, wiping of the computer, all right at the moment when it was at its pinnacle of success of this remarkable mission. And it was not mechanical. It appears to have been initiated by a computer.
Meanwhile, our rovers break down, get fixed, break down, get fixed. They're still alive, and they're still doing incredible work on Mars.
You know, you got to hand it to NASA and JPL. They created, and I watched the various documentaries on this team, the rover Athena team that was put together. I mean, these people have lived 24/7 with these two little robots, doughty robots, roving across Mars. They were only supposed to last 3 months, you know, 90 days. They have now lasted 2 Martian years and then some, and are going strong. They had a problem with Opportunity's robot arm the other day, and they have come up, you know, with a workaround.
Yeah, they fixed it again. Richard, stay with us. We'll be back. We'll talk about this Virgin Galactic in the spaceport in New Mexico, and we'll open up the phone lines. We'll do a half-hour conversations with Richard C. Hoagland. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, are you interested in a wonderful Christmas present for someone who loves to listen to Coast and is really involved in science and mysteries? It's the God, Man, and E.T. DVD series, critically acclaimed. You can get that by calling 1-877-345-6222. I'll give that to you again. That's 877-345-6222. Richard C. Hoagland has also put up some information on this on the enterprisemission.com website, and you can get it just in time for the holidays. The God, Man, and E.T. DVD series. 1-877-345-6222, or go to the enterprisemission.com website. And welcome back. Conversations with Richard C. Hoagland. We'll take your phone calls. And Richard Branson, of course, head of Virgin Airlines, now has Virgin Galactic. He's teaming up with the state of New Mexico, your state. They're going to build a spaceport, minimal lease money for the next 5 years. Then it'll gradually go up. But this guy, I got to tell you, this guy's an entrepreneur. He's got thousands of people sending in money to go up into space.
Apparently, something like 38,000 people have already signed up.
I think that's great.
I think it's phenomenal, but I'm also very intrigued with a couple of things that have occurred around this. One is, have you seen the logo of the new project?
I have not seen the logo, and also they're going to build most of this thing underground.
That's the thing that really has kind of rung my chimes, as they used to say. And it's here in New Mexico. It's just south of a little town, kind of far south of where we are tonight, called Truth or Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, talk about a name. I mean, the name of that town is really interesting, and its own history goes back to the Ralph Edwards radio and TV show, you know.
Yeah.
We have friends that actually live in Truth or Consequences, so we've been invited down to kind of, you know, see what's going on, and I intend to take advantage of that since we're here in the land of enchantment. But yeah, when I heard the plans that this was going to be built mostly underground, I got very suspicious, and I'll tell you why. When I see you in February there in L.A., mm-hmm. I'm going to be doing two major events at the L.A. Expo on unveiling our research into 2012. I know that Peter is going to be talking somewhat tonight about it, and I'm really looking forward, as is Robin, to hearing his thoughts on it, but we put together some very interesting research having to do with what might happen vis-a-vis the physics in 2012.
All right.
One of the things, if you were concerned about what would be happening climatologically, atmospherically, in terms of weather, if you're going to build a large facility, the safest place, if you're concerned about those things, is to put it underground.
That's right.
And I'm really intrigued that Branson is inveigled the state of New Mexico, which is not rich. I mean, this is not a rich state. It's one of the poorer states in the country.
Yeah, this is almost a $300 million project.
And $100 million is being pledged from the state by our Governor Richardson, who, as you know, was Clinton's energy secretary.
Right.
And some say it might be in line to run for the presidency in 2008 against Hillary. But the thing that intrigues me is that two-thirds of that money is kind of unaccounted for. And there's a large potential federal component. Now, this is being billed as a private spaceport. But, you know, if you look at the technology that Burt Rutan is developing, which is this kind of flying shuttlecock that yeah. goes 60-some miles up and then comes back down, doesn't go into orbit. Why would one spend so much money developing a facility underground to basically launch gliders.
That's a good question.
In other words, I think there's something more here than meets the eye. Let me read to you one of the things that Sir Richard said this afternoon at the press conference. He said, we're going where no one has gone before. There's no model to follow, nothing to copy. That's what makes this so exciting. We might even be able to allow those aliens who landed at Roswell 50 years ago UFO a chance to go home. Which brings us to the logo.
Could have been tongue-in-cheek. Tell me about the logo.
If you look at the logo, it is basically an eye. It's the iris of an eye with all those radial lines in blue with a sun peeking out from behind because it's supposed to be an eye in eclipse. And it looks nothing more like than, which is a terrible mangled sentence, than the close-ups in 2001 of Keir DeLay's eyes when he falls through the Stargate.
Interesting.
In fact, the eye itself looks like the Stargate on the television show Stargate. All of which, I have no idea what it means, George, but my radar is saying, watch this space very carefully because you're not being told, again, the full story.
Well, dramatic, though, as it is, I want to see this thing built, don't you?
So, of course I do.
Absolutely.
I want to go. In fact, Richardson said he wants to be one of the first guys to take off from there. He didn't say whether he wanted to go to space or just to Washington.
They're talking about what, 2008, 2009 to get a flight?
They're talking about breaking ground in 2007, and this is really breaking ground because it will be underground, as we said, to be completed by 2009 or 2010. But they'll be able to start doing actual operations probably by 2008, yes.
All right, Richard, let's go to the calls. First-time caller line, you're on the air on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. How you doing this morning?
We are well, thank you.
My question to Richard was about meteorites. I've been seeing tons of them everywhere for the last 3 days. I've probably counted about 12. What's the deal with that? Is that normal, or what's going on?
Well, sometimes we pass through meteor streams, you know, which are the bits and pieces of comets that kind of trail off as the object goes through space. I don't know off the top of my head if we passed through any recent meteor showers. I know in November we go through what's called the Leonids. We have the Orionids coming up in a few days, I believe. You also have random meteors, you know, which are these little specks of dust and rock that enter the atmosphere. So without actually seeing what you saw, I don't know whether it's that unusual or not, but keep watching the skies. That's all, you know, I would recommend.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say to George, thanks for keeping me awake on all my long drives that I go through every night. Currently driving right now, actually.
All right. Well, you are more than welcome. And also, I think we're right in the middle of Richard of the Geminids.
Oh, that's right. You know, the Geminids are in here, too.
So, you know,
so that's probably what you're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. Wild card line, you are on Coast to Coast with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi there.
Hi there. This is Cynthia from Evansville, Indiana.
Hello, Cynthia.
I have a question, and I just want to say I'm honored to be on the line. I listen every night for as long as I possibly can. Richard, I want to know if they are hiding or wanting to hide the information that they received from their little bot that they sent out in space that landed. If someone wanted to sabotage it, why did they send it out in the first place?
Well, you're not talking about the same folks. You're talking about competing interests, and you raise an interesting possibility.
Okay.
Maybe the story of the perils of Pauline, the little spacecraft that suddenly falls apart, is just that. Maybe it's just a story.
Oh,
in other words, the problem with space is that we have no way of gaining independent information. We're dependent on the official sources, which is why someday, if Branson is really serious, I'd like to see him, you know, send private missions to the moon and Mars and other places, so that we all could get to see our data as we get our data.
Well, he might. Let me tell you, this guy's got a knack to succeed, appears to be able to raise all kinds of money that he needs it. He probably will get to the moon, maybe before we will again.
One of the cool things would be to, reserve a seat on one of these suborbital spacecraft they're going to launch and then carry out some of the investigations that Tim Ventura and I at American Anti-Gravity have been talking about. Because you know that rockets is not the way of the future, George. Rockets are basically dinosaurs. The real way to get lots of people cheaply into space is to come up with a stunning breakthrough propulsion system.
What do you think of this ion system? Do you think that's it?
The ion system?
Yeah.
Not really. Because, again, you're shooting stuff out the back end, a la Newton's third law, to make the spacecraft go forward. What you want is a field propulsion system that hooks into space or the ether itself and allows you to hover weightless or to accelerate at very high speed without expending any fuel. And one of the cool things would be we could now, as private citizens, test that kind of a drive in one of Branson's spaceships leaving from New Mexico in the next few years if this proceeds at the rate it seems to be going.
I wonder if I can talk my network into coughing up the 200,000 to get
400,000, George.
Is it four now? Oh, two is what, the deposit?
No, it's you and me.
No. Someone, I, Richard, will be staying behind broadcasting the show. Someone will need to carry the torch to keep the show going while you do your inserts. 200,000.
I thought we'd go together.
200,000. You expect
it's about $200,000 for one seat. Yes.
You want me to be trapped in a space capsule with you?
You mean you wouldn't go?
You know what? I probably would.
I'll bet you would.
But I would like you to go first because it's a dream for you.
Well, it would be pretty cool.
Yep, sure would. International Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, I'm calling from Winnipeg, Canada.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, Richard and George. My thinking about this is this seems like a lot of money and effort to just, Richard said, put up shuttlecocks, small, simple spacecraft. It seems like maybe it's just a guise for something, bigger. Like what you're saying about the funding, a large gap of it could be federal. Maybe it's associated with some kind of military project.
I don't know whether it's military, because you wouldn't involve Branson, you wouldn't involve civilians, but I do think it may be presaging something much more exciting on the private space front, like an alternate propulsion system, if you're going to be bringing people from all over the planet, 38,000 so far have signed up, to New Mexico, think about that. Why are we doing that? And why are we building a $200, $300 million facility underground to do that? There's just something more to this than meets the eye, and my job is to raise these issues and let people make their own decisions.
Hey, Richard, what if we're going to build just a landing port for extraterrestrials? you never know.
Branson did mention Roswell.
Shades out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
It sure would be, wouldn't it?
Yep. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Larry.
Hi.
I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I wondered if you knew about the. I came across some the other day. The longest word is a great long word, and it's African, and it translates to cat chasing mouse. It's the name of a lake, and for hundreds of years, no one knew why it was called Cat Chasing Mouse Lake, because this is a giant, giant, giant lake. Until our first space travel, when we took the picture back of Earth, and the outline of that lake is a cat chasing a mouse.
Now that's a great story.
That's cool.
Yeah.
You could only see from space.
You could only see it from way out. They couldn't even see it from a jetliner or it just has to be way, way out.
So obviously your question is, how did they know it to call it that before they could get up high enough to see it?
Unless somebody told them, Richard. Hey, what do you think of Eric von Däniken and his theories?
Well, he was ahead of his time. I was not a big fan in the early years, and I wrote such in Monuments. I must say that, you know, during the break, you know, one of your promos was on for, I guess, After Dark, and you talk mm-hmm. about the conspiracies that we talk about on this program that turn out to be true.
Yes.
Well, one of the big conspiracies that Van Doniken pointed out 30 years ago was that, you know, the human race was a lot older and a lot more intelligent and had built many extraordinary things from previous epochs of high civilization, and that we'd had contact with extraterrestrials. And frankly, the data is now tending to prove that he was right.
I used to read his works as a kid, and I was just obsessed with the things he did.
Did you ever think you'd be hosting a show where we talk about it every night?
I wanted to. I didn't think I would at the time, but strange things happen, Richard C.
Be careful East. What you wish for.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George, Richard, Merry Christmas.
Aw, Merry Christmas to you, too.
Thank you. This is Carrie. I'm calling from Western North Carolina. And I had a question for Richard. If you were to take, let's say, a computer simulation and take the Earth and remove all the water from all the oceans, all the lakes and everything, would our Earth then not look kind of like an apple that had been eaten away on the outside and just kind of a core, like maybe it was only part of a planet that may have been struck by another planet or an asteroid or something in the past?
Not really, because the deepest oceans are maybe 5-6 miles, and the Earth is 8,000 miles across, so you do the math.
Right.
If you took away all the water, it would look wrinkled, it would look furrowed, it would look dry and like a desert, but it wouldn't look like an eaten apple.
Well, I mean, I was just using that as an analogy, but, I mean, it just seems like if you took away all the water, you know, there'd be huge chunks, like, maybe we were a larger planet and something smashed into us and knocked bits and pieces away.
The thing that would prohibit that is that the Earth is a dynamic living system, and I don't mean that in the biological sense, but it's got a lot of geology. When it gets hit by large things, the scars are covered up by a lot of different processes. So even if, you know, the Tiamat scenario that Zachariah Sitchin talks about were true, it would have healed from that process in the, you know, millions and billions of years since that would have taken place.
Oh, okay. And also, George, I wanted to mention to you, the latest Popular Science had a really cool thing on creating black holes in the laboratory.
Yes.
They showed some of the machinery they did it with and, you know, had a whole article about it. I thought you might find interesting.
And there's no
doubt about it. They're starting to do these things, and they're marvelous. Richard, we're almost out of time. I do have a question, though, because I mentioned the Godman and E.T. series. Can you get it out in time for Christmas?
Our very gorgeous folks up at the distribution center are working day and night to get it out. If people go to the website or if they call that 800 number, which is 1-877-345-6222, we can make it by Christmas, but the time is disappearing fast, so get your order in. It is the most remarkable Christmas present because it encompasses the biggest questions possible at this particular time of the year, so appropriate. And, you know, get it for someone you really care about, then sit down and watch it together with them, and you'll have an awful lot of fun and an interesting evening. I guarantee it.
Can you believe Christmas is so close?
No, no.
My gosh.
It was just a few weeks ago we were talking about last Christmas.
I know. It just keeps
rolling
along.
Where has this year gone, and where is the next year going to go? You'll see, you know, Art was right when he talked about the quickening. Things are happening faster and faster and faster.
And I think 2006 is going to be a very fascinating year.
It will not be boring.
You got that.
I guarantee you.
Thanks, Richard.
Should
keep
I make
in touch.
A reservation?
For one.
For one.
See you later. Take care. We'll be back in a moment. Peter Gersten will be our guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norris.